Party's ready. All right. Good morning. We are going to get started. I think it's on. Is this on? Yeah, it shows that it's on. Okay. Good morning. It's September 9th, 2025 at 8:30 a.m. This is the time and date scheduled for consolidated hearings set by the Notice of Consolidated Hearing issued by the North Dakota Public Service Commission on June 4th, 2025 for case numbers PU-25-75 and PU-25-76. My name is Hope Hogan, and I have been designated as the hearing officer for today's hearing. This hearing is being held today at the Commission Hearing Room at the North Dakota State Capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota. As we begin our hearing, I'd ask everybody to please check your cell phones to make sure they're either silenced or turned off so that we don't have cell phone interruptions during our hearing today. In a minute, I'm going to send around an attendance sheet, and the Commission would ask everyone to please sign it so that there's a record of all who attended today's hearing. This hearing concerns an application of Montana Dakota Utilities Company for an advance determination of prudence and a certificate of public convenience and necessity for a 49% ownership interest, which represents 122.5 megawatts of the Badger Wind Project currently being constructed near Wishick in Logan and McIntosh counties. The Notice of Consolidated Hearing specifies the following issues to be considered and determined at this hearing. For case number PU-25-75, which is the application for advance prudence, the issue is whether MDU should be granted an advance determination that a proposed resource addition is prudent. And for case number PU-25-76, which is the application for certificate of public convenience and necessity, the issues are, first, whether public convenience and necessity will be served by construction and operation of the facilities, and number two, is MDU technically, financially, and managerially fit and able to provide the services? I'm now going to ask the parties to make their appearances for their record. Mr. Simpson, do you want to state your appearance for the record and introduce the witnesses you intend to call today?
Thank you, Your Honor. Zev Simpson, Dorsey & Whitney, on behalf of Montana Dakota Utilities. With me is Travis Jacobson, and we intend to call Mr. Darcy Nigam to the stand.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Do you want to state your appearance for the record? Introduce the staff who's appearing with you today and indicate whether the commission intends to call any witnesses.
Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of advocacy staff. With me is Robert Frank and Adam Renfant, who have both been appointed advocacy staff. Available remotely is Jim Heidel, if the commission should desire to have any questions from him.
All right. And Mr. Johnson, do you want to state your appearance for the record and introduce staff that's appearing with you today?
Sure. Brian Johnson, LB Advisory for the Public Service Commission. With me is Victor Shook. Unless anybody intends to call him as a witness today, I'd ask that he be allowed to ask questions as well.
All right. Thank you. I'm not sure if we have any members of the public at our hearing today, but testimony from the public will be taken at the completion of the party's witness testimony today. I encourage any member from the public to take this opportunity to tell the commission anything they think they should know about this matter. I assure you what you have to say is important to the commission and will be considered by the commission. We'll now take opening comments from the commissioners, and I'll start with you, Commissioner Haugenhoffert.
Good morning, everyone. I thought I would see more purple today. But it's good to see everyone here. I look forward to the testimony presented and the ability to ask some questions. So that's all I have.
Commissioner Christman?
Nothing to add, Your Honor, but good morning, everyone.
Commissioner Kringsted?
No opening comments for me either. Just thanks for being here today, everybody.
All right. Mr. Simpson, I received from you this morning 12 exhibits that I intend to... that I assume you intend to offer as part of this proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our application, direct testimony, rebuttal testimony of Mr. Heidel, the settlement agreement, the settlement testimony of Mr. Frank, as well as the opening statement of Mr. Nigam. And we would stipulate them into the record, subject to FEC staff being okay with it.
Mr. Armstrong, are you willing to stipulate to admission of the exhibits?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Johnson?
No objection.
All right. So exhibits 1 through 12 will be entered into the record for this matter. I'll just ask if there's any other preliminary matters we need to address before we move to testimony, Mr. Simpson.
Just two items, Your Honor. One, Mr. Nigam will have a PowerPoint as part of his opening statement, and he'll carry the opening statement for MDU.
Did you want to mark the slides as an exhibit?
The slides
or
are
not
marked as
exhibit. Oh, they are. They're in there. Okay.
Exhibit 11.
Okay. Perfect. Mr. Armstrong, any preliminary matters?
I'm nothing other than I wasn't clear earlier. We do intend to call Robert Frank, and then Mr. Heidel is available remotely if desired.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Johnson, anything?
Nothing, Your Honor.
All right. Then, Mr. Simpson, you can call your witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. MDU calls Mr. Darcy Nigam.
Good morning, Mr. Nigam.
Good morning.
Before you testify this morning, well, actually, I'll have you start by stating your full name for the record and spelling your last name.
Darcy Nigam, N-E-I-G-U-M.
Mr. Nigam, before you testify today, I'm required by law to advise you on the penalties for perjury in the state of North Dakota. Perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Do you understand what perjury is?
Yes, I do.
And being advised of the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Nigam. Are you the same Darcy Nigam that submitted a direct testimony in this proceeding?
Yes, I am.
And I understand you have an opening statement today?
I do.
All right. With that, the witness is available for cross.
Mr. Armstrong, any questions?
No questions.
And Mr. Johnson stepped out, so Commissioner Haugenhofer.
Your Honor, would it be possible for Mr. Nigam to...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Opening? Thank you.
I thought you said you didn't have any other questions, so I was distracted. Sorry.
Okay. Good morning, Commissioners. So regarding the matter of the Badger Wind project and the ADP and CPCN hearing we have today, I think we've already heard of the three issues that are at least identified to be answered as part of the proceeding for the ADP and the CPCN. Is Montana Dakota proposed Badger Wind project resource addition prudent? Whether the public convenience and necessity will be served by the construction and operation of the facilities, and whether the applicant is technically, financially, and managerially fit and able to provide service. The Badger Wind Project is a fully permitted and sited wind project located near Wishart, North Dakota. The project consists of 92 General Electric 2.82 megawatt wind turbines with a total net output of 250 megawatts. The substation for the interconnection is connected to Montana Dakota's 230 kV Wishart Northwest substation. The Badger Wind Project began physical construction in 2024 and is scheduled to be completed by the end of December 2025. The project is forecasted to have a 35-year project life. This is a layout of the Badger Wind project near Wishart. So on the map, there ends up being the collector substation is here and MDU substation is right here that it ends up having on that short overhead transmission line that's built. May 12, 2022, Montana Dakota Utilities signed a generator interconnection agreement with Badger Wind, LLC. The early part of 2024, Badger Wind reached out and entered into a facility service agreement corresponding with the network upgrades required on MDU's system between MDU and MISO. That was a signal to MDU that Badger Wind was going to be moving forward with their project development. In March of 2024, MDU reached out to Ørsted, a parent of Badger Wind LLC, about potential offtake arrangements. Those conversations led in the development of our 2024 Integrated Resource Plan to a sensitivity that we called the 150 megawatt power purchase scenario. The Badger Wind Power Purchase Agreement that Montana Dakota entered into was signed on November 4th of 2024. It consisted of 150 megawatts of output from the 250 megawatt project. It included a flat energy price that included all capacity and renewable attributes with the project, and it also contained a 49% undivided ownership interest in the project. In our 2024 Integrated Resource Plan, included in that was the expiration of the power purchase agreement that Montana Dakota Utilities has with Minn Kota Power. That agreement runs through May 31st of 2026. We had reached out prior during the development of the 2024 Integrated Resource Plan to Minn Kota, and we were unable to extend that agreement. That agreement did compose of 75 megawatts of energy around the clock and 30 megawatts of capacity that was a part of that. Montana Dakota did include the Badger Wind project as a single sensitivity run and was included in all four cases that were a part of our integrated resource plan. That project or that sensitivity and option was considered the new wind opportunity in the sensitivity and the resource plan. As part of that IRP for 2024, we did have four base cases. Two of those dealt with the winter and summer resource adequacy requirements under MISO's current requirements. And then we also included what was proposed and had been filed with FERC was around the direct loss of load accreditation. So we had four scenarios, winter, summer for the current resource adequacy and winter and summer for direct loss of load. In all four cases, the new wind opportunity had a lower net present value over the 50-year study period over what our base case was. Only one sensitivity was run regarding the Badger Wind opportunity because the opportunity was presented to us late in part of the 2024 IRP process. We did include in the IRP an action item for the continued evaluation of this project opportunity. So secondary from that IRP that we filed, we did do an additional analysis that was filed as a part of this case. In that, we included the 49% ownership interest purchase, which would be 122.5 megawatts, and then a remainder power purchase agreement of 27.5 megawatts. And that was included in all of the base cases and all of the sensitivities that we had run in the original IRP. So we basically reran all of the modeling, including what would be the purchase option and also the remainder power purchase agreement. In all four study cases, the ownership option plus the remainder PPA was selected in the modeling as a least cost option for the company. The summer direct loss of load, the ownership option was selected in all sensitivities, and the PPA option was selected in all except for the low market and low natural gas price sensitivity. In the winter direct loss of load, the ownership option was selected in all the sensitivities and the PPA option in all but the increase in renewables by 50% and an increase in demand response by 10% scenario. Regarding the ownership option, it was for a 49% undivided interest. It does reduce the power purchase agreement if we close on that transaction from 150 megawatts to 27.5. So we would still have a power purchase agreement with the project. Total cost of the project is expected at $195.5 million. That includes $294 million for the purchase of Badger Wind and then an additional $1.5 million of owner's cost for our project purchase. The transaction on the purchase option would be effective on the commercial operation date for the project, which is expected the end of this year. Condition precedent in that purchase agreement is a requirement for the ADP and the CPCN to be approved by September 30th of 2025, so coming up here at the end of the month. If that condition is not met, we would be bound by the 20-year power purchase agreement for the whole 150 megawatts of output. Badger Wind has a long-term maintenance service agreement that is signed with the turbine manufacturer, which includes all of the maintenance and replacement parts. The project does qualify for the full production tax credits, which also includes the 10% bonus domestic content adder, and the project is on track to be completed by the end of the year and also at the target purchase price for Montana Dakota. Currently, there are 450 contractors on site working on the project, and they actually finished topping out the first turbine last week. So construction is going very well. The ownership option provides $121.5 million in the 50-year net present value savings over the least cost sensitivity that would have been the new wind opportunity that was included in the 2024 IRP. So that's the comparison between the sensitivity that included the new wind opportunity and then in the base case that we would have for the winter direct loss of load that would have selected the purchase option and the remainder PPA. Also, the ownership option does provide $233 million in modeled net present value savings over the 50-year study period from the original base case that would be part of the 2024 IRP to what was modeled as far as the updated analysis in the base case. The project ownership option also provides $30 million in net present value savings when evaluated over the 35-year project life, and also $14.2 million net present value savings over the initial 20-year period. That would be the term of the power purchase agreement as compared to the MISO energy market purchases that were used in the 2024 IRP. The company and advocacy staff did enter into a settlement agreement regarding these proceedings for the ADP and the CPCN cases on September 3rd, 2025. Customary with other projects that we've had recently was the inclusion at least to, for a total capital expenditures of $295.5 million to be included in the order. Also, the normalization of the production tax credits as we've done with other projects and consistent with what other utilities have been doing in the state. And then also hearing concerns from advocacy staff and their consultant just around production. We did include a profit sharing or production sharing mechanism that basically if the company's annual revenue requirement would be reduced by $285,000 if on a three-year rolling average the output of the production from the project was less than a 42% capacity factor. So in conclusion, the company's requests for approval of the Badger Wind Project ADP and CPCN application and settlement agreement we're asking for. This does meet all the requirements for an ADP and a CPCN. It does provide a prudent and long-term investment for our customers. Badger Wind is a low-cost generating resource, as demonstrated through the company's 2024 IRP and the initial additional analysis that we conducted. The project helps the company meet the future energy needs for its customers, and it reduces our dependencies on market purchases and provides market energy price protection. And that is the end of my presentation.
The witness is available for cross.
All right. Mr. Armstrong, any questions?
No questions.
Mr. Johnson?
I don't have any, but Victor might.
I'd like to talk a little bit about PTC levelization. So I guess my first question is, was the PTC levelization calculation used when calculating the net present value savings?
It was, it was not.
It was not? So that was just assuming the standard PTC utilization over the first 10 years of the life?
That's correct.
Okay. So what kind of impact would that have on that analysis? Would that be more beneficial or less beneficial considering the PTC levelization for in the net present value calculation?
I would have to defer that to Mr. Davidson if he has that information available.
Okay. and then in you did some calculations kind of after the fact of the PTC levelization, which so way back when we first started talking about PTC levelization, man, I forget how many years ago it was, but there was two different methods of levelization of PTCs. There was one method where the PTCs, the estimated PTCs for the project were levelized relative to the revenue requirement over the life of the project. And there was another one that kind of tried to levelize the cost of a wind farm over the life of the project. Do you know which of those two methods was used?
It would end up being the second one.
Okay. So that was one, when we kind of developed those two methods way back when, one of them was used, I think, only in MDU's case because we had a wind facility that was in year five or six, maybe even more than that, of operation. So it was a little more palatable to use that method versus the straight levelization method is kind of what we referred to the other one as. Would there be any objection to modifying that for this? And I mean, I realize within this ADP, we don't necessarily need to specify the PTC levelization method. It would probably happen if this is approved through the renewable resource adjustment whenever that's filed. But
yeah, I don't see that as an issue and something certainly we could work with staff to work through that.
Okay. One other question I had as I was looking at the PTC information, I think it was towards the end of not your testimony, I forget whose it was, but are you using a 20-year life or the full, because I think I'd heard that this project is expected to have a 35-year useful life, but on this page I'm looking at, it looks like PTC levelization is done over 20 years.
Okay. I believe that it is over the 20 years, I believe is what we ended up doing.
Okay. Do you know what the reason is for 20 years versus the full useful life of 35?
I think that's just consistent with other projects that we've done. And certainly, you know, I think it does leave as well. It's the question currently today, based upon tax structure, if you did have a repower, you'd be able to requalify. So it ends up being that question, do you plan for the 35-year life, you know, and that levelization, or do you assume that there could be that possibility of repower, and then how would you handle that as well?
Sure, sure.
So I think it's just trying to get that value to customers over that first 20 years.
Okay. I think that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Commissioner Haugenhofer.
Good morning, Darcy.
You alluded to the substations on your one page. The design was built for 250 megawatts. Is there any upgrades that need to be done with the substations or any upgrades for this project at all?
So there ends up being an upgrade that was needed to be done at the substation as part of the interconnection request that was for an additional breaker bay to be added. At the same time, we had also looked at which the Badger Wind project would be responsible for. Mm-hmm. We also do have a reconductoring of the 230 kV line that goes from Wishick to Maricourt. That's a part of the required network upgrades.
And all that upgrade is on time? As you indicated, the project is on time too?
Yes, it is. The upgrades that Montana Dakota has.
Okay. In the IRP, you talked about the need for this energy. Is it for current need or is it projected need? Talk about the need in that area.
Sure. The need would be for both, for the customers today and then also in the future. So I mentioned the expiration of the power purchase agreement we have with Minn Kota Power. And so that agreement expires in May of 2026. Without replacing that power purchase agreement, by looking at what our forecasted models are, we'd be in the market for almost up to 50% of our customers' load that we would have based upon current market price forecasts that are out there. So it does reduce our dependency. We do have a need for the energy, and it does show at least that both the power purchase agreement and the ownership option are a lesser option than what would end up being market purchases on a forecast. And then we also have need for the capacity that the project does provide because the PPA also has 30 megawatts of capacity with Minn Kota that's expiring.
Can you explain a little bit more about the cost analysis, why going to the market is so much higher and kind of the analysis that you run, just an overview on that, on how to get down to the cost benefit?
Sure. So we do go out for a third-party forecast, which is with Woods and McKenzie, to end up with what that forward pricing looks like. And that is for our area, not just, you know, the MISO as a whole or at least something like the Minnesota Hub Price. It would be specific for Montana Dakota's area. in that we use that price in the base case, and then we also have sensitivities around what if the price of the market was higher than that, you know, $5, $10 higher than that, and what also if it was lower than what was forecasted as well. And those are some of the sensitivities that are run to at least test the viability of this project option against what market prices would be.
Okay. Thank you. You allude to the sensitivities, the modeling that you ran, the four base cases. I understand it, but how would you explain it to the general public that aren't familiar with RTOs and market analysis and all that, the sensitivities that you run to say that this is the best option, why you came up with the best option?
Commissioner Haugenhofer, so historically, you know, when we look at needing to plan for our system, we have to meet our peak day. Mm-hmm. We are a summer peaking utility, so we meet our peak day. That also is the condition at least the MISO RTO also peaks under, is that peak day. So historically, we would have to show that we have enough credit that ends up meeting that peak day obligation that we would have coincident with MISO's peak, and then also have a given planning reserve margin on top of that. So historically, when we would plan, we would always look at just the summer season, because mm-hmm. that's the most limiting one with the planning reserve margin. There's been a lot of talk and work in the industry of just looking in the future. Do we continue to say at a summer peaking requirement, or is it also, could that move to a different season? And so looking ahead that MISO has done, and also some history with some of the winter storm events and other things that have happened, we end up seeing the need as well in the winter time to at least that potentially that could end up being the limiting season as well. And we also see that there are higher planning reserve margins that both RTOs in the state, MISO and Southwest Power Pool, have been adding higher planning reserve margins in the winter just to accommodate some of those risks. So that's why we looked at in this IRP of both the summer and the winter requirements to make sure that we were seeing what was the most limiting case, and then also looked at what was planned for the future, moving away from that peak hour to more of the riskiest hours that are part of direct loss of load accreditation, looked at what those requirements would end up being for both the summer and the winter season. And the direct loss of load accreditation, that will become effective. It was approved by FERC, so that goes into effect on June 1 of 2028. So we tested around summer, winter, as resource adequacy is today, and then also in the future, what does it look like under direct loss of load? And then we also went through a number of sensitivities that change what's the market pricing, what's fuel pricing, what if our load is more or less than what we forecasted, and then a number of other sensitivities were required to run in North Dakota or in Montana that we end up having for modeling requirements were all included in that analysis. And in that, the purchase option with the remainder PPA was selected as the least cost resource in all of those sensitivities and base cases that we would have for the additional analysis.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions at this time.
Commissioner Chrisman?
You said you reached out to Mincota but were unable to extend the PPA, right?
That is correct, Commissioner Chrisman.
Was that a matter of pricing, or did they just not want have other places where they wanted to use that energy and not have an interest in a PPA under any circumstances?
It wasn't available, and I think that was based upon other opportunities that they had or needs for that capacity.
So Mr. Heidel is wrong on page 6 of his testimony when he said MDU did not conduct price discovery through either a resource bidding process or solicit a replacement PPA for the Mincota project.
We did not go out for a competitive solicitation for all projects that might be available as part of this. We did reach out to Mincota to see what was available to extend the power purchase agreement or renew it.
And that was nothing.
and that was nothing was available.
Okay. And a number of my questions do have to do with Mr. Heidel's testimony that I just want to get clarification from you. He says the utility is not forecasting significant load growth, excluding data centers, and the project is not associated with data center demand. So am I reading into it correctly? If that is right, that basically this is to replace the Minn Kota.
This is to replace the Minn Kota. When we look at our forecasted growth that was a part of the 2024 Integrated Resource Plan, it's less than 0.4% per year. When we've looked at requirements to serve the data center loads, those that are under Rate 45, those are served separately from the portfolio of resources we have for the rest of our customers. So, as you said, Commissioner Crisman, this resource is just to supply our existing customers, and it is fulfills the need to replace the Minn Kota power purchase agreement.
I seen you had kind of a big binder. Do you have Mr. Heidel's testimony with you?
I do not have it in front of me. Thank you.
Actually, why don't I think I'll just save this question for Mr. Heidel.
Okay.
I'm sure then if you disagree with him, you can, Mr. Simpson will call you back up or something.
Sounds like a plan.
He does state, and I didn't write down what page this was on, that conservative PTC inflation assumption was used. I don't know really what that meant. Do you? What is your assumption here? Is it that you'll have this for 35 years, and you'll get 10 years of PTCs, and that's it? Or have you already calculated in additional PTCs or larger PTCs? Or how do you model that? Because that's a pretty significant amount of the revenue from owning wind farms.
Commissioner Crisman, I believe what Mr. Heidel is referring to in the revenue requirement modeling that the company did to come up with what's the annual cost of energy for this project to our customers, that way we can compare that number on an annual basis against what the PPA would have and also MISO market energy prices. The modeling we had assumed a starting price for production tax credits that was at $28 per megawatt hour. Okay, and I think that when he says conservative, it's a conservative starting point. The value of production tax credits for last year would end up being at $30. So they've already increased $2 more than what we had modeled. And we would end up seeing there'll be another, and that's an annual update, at least that the Treasury does on those levels every year to see what the value of it is. So it's very likely the starting point after the first year of production for the project, you know, will likely be over $31 per megawatt hour. So it'll be $3 more than what we modeled. We are expecting the project to receive the full 10 years of production tax credits, and it also does qualify for the 10% bonus adder for domestic content. And we included both those pieces, the 10-year life and the 10% bonus for domestic content. But we have a lower starting value for the production tax credits than what it's expected to be when the project goes in service for the first year.
Can you explain to me your optimism about Treasury increasing PTCs and moving forward in the direction that they probably did in the last few years when only a few weeks ago they completely rewrote the safe harbor rules, is my understanding, and really cut into future PTCs for new projects?
Yes. So regarding the safe harbor, you know, that was really around how you qualify for, you know, the start of construction and continuous efforts, what would meet those definitions. The other piece around that annual update, you know, is separate from that. And that's been a customary practice since the production tax credits were developed initially, is that, and that's more based upon the inflationary CPI sorts of look at what is that change from year to year. So that's been a customary piece. I don't think I've seen any talk about that changing. And as I mentioned, we're expected to be $3 less per megawatt hour we model than what it's very likely to be the first year goes in service. And we're certainly $2 less on what we model for production tax credits as compared to what it was this year when it was updated at 30.
But increasing that for inflation may be customary, but yep. Wasn't it also customary to continually extend the guidelines for new projects qualifying too? And now that custom certainly got changed.
Yeah, Commissioner Christman. So what we are including or included for an inflationary adjustment, because we didn't assume the production tax credits were flat for 10 years, we only assumed a 1.5% increase per year is what we have. So assuming that there is no change or increase, we're probably looking at 4 years to 5 years is what it's going to take before we would end up seeing the tax credits would basically, if it's starting at $30 today, it would end up taking probably that 4 or 5 years for it to get to $30 from the 28 that we modeled at 1.5%. So it's pretty conservative what we had included. And even if it would not increase, and I don't think there's any talk that it won't continue to have an inflationary update, you know, we're still well below what's currently available as compared to what we modeled.
Okay. I think I will ask you right away about this on from Mr. Heidel's testimony on page 13. I'm confused about the summer zonal, what is the
ZRCs or
ZRCs,
zonal resource credits.
Resource credits for natural gas being more than the nameplate. Is that confused me.
Okay.
Can you explain it? Or is that a bad question for him?
It's probably more for Mr. Heidel, because I think he took some of this information that was a part of our analysis we included in the IRP. And I did not go, or we did not go to verify if that table was correct or not. So
okay,
I'm not in a position to answer that.
I'll inquire there. And I'm done, Your Honor. Thank you.
Commissioner Kringstad?
Thank you. You touched on this a little bit in your application, but maybe just expand upon it a little bit. Why ownership, partial ownership of this project is preferable to just like a full PPA?
Commissioner Kringstad, so in just a traditional PPA, you know, one of the things we've seen is, and we've modeled before, is at least there's additional benefits that come with ownership. You know, part of that is beyond the 20-year power purchase agreement, you have certainty where you're going to be in years 21 through 35 that you end up having. The other one, in a power purchase agreement, there is a lot of items that a developer will take as far as in risk, you know, whether that's in maintenance costs they expect, what it could end up being, and also performance of the project, and they will price that in. And so there actually is almost an additional cost they're basically pricing in, especially would be in outer years as compared to what actually would cost. When we look at the ownership, there ends up being just that actuals that are returned from customers. And even in the case if you had an overproduction year, you know, that value all goes back to the developer, and they take all of that additional sales and put that, you know, revenue in their pocket, because they're going to continue to get paid what the power purchase agreement, you know, was in that case. In the ownership piece, if you would produce greater than the P50 production, the customers get the benefit of that. And so it flows back to them as a reduced cost for that ownership for us and supplying our customers for that particular year. At the end of the project life, you know, the interconnections still have value to be able to develop other projects if it deals with repowering projects. So we would have that available to us as well, as far as knowing, you know, we'd be able to redevelop something on this site, you know, in partnership, or how whatever play out with Ørsted at year 35 would be available. Otherwise, we would be back into just starting with another greenfield project, you know, and taking a look at, you know, what the cost of interconnections would be.
Okay. So with the partial ownership, do you see any risks or have any concerns with just the partial ownership piece? So say, like, I guess one thing that comes to my mind is, you know, if one party wants to repower, but the other party wants to retire, you know, and you're just not aligned, like, in that regard. Sure. So any concerns there?
Commissioner Krinkstad, we had a lot of conversations when we were developing. You know, there's an asset purchase agreement we entered into, and then also a co-tenancy for the ongoing operation. So a lot of thought was placed into that. What happens in kind of those repowering events, unwinding events? What if somebody doesn't meet their, you know, ongoing obligation requirements? So there's a lot of thought in there and a lot of optionalities that we have to either come to terms of agreement or basically one party to be able to, you know, purchase the other one out. So we tried to encompass those scenarios as a part of this arrangement.
Okay. You touched on this a little, well, not a little, quite a bit with Commissioner Christman, but just to reiterate, the PTC analysis that you've done, in your opinion, is still accurate in light of, like, the recent federal changes with, like, the reconciliation bill and everything like that?
What we modeled is still accurate. It's conservative and have not seen anything that would change to not include an adjustment factor on an annual basis. Okay. To the PTCs.
You had discussed modeling a little bit with Commissioner Haugenhoffert, and I think my question here ties into this when you talked about how, you know, MDU is currently like a summer peaking utility, but looking forward, you know, maybe there's additional risk coming in the winter. So in the pre-file testimony, and it wasn't yours, it was Mr. Giggy's on page 4, it talked about how the capacity credits and updated MISO values from the 2025-26 loss of load study, that actually decreased, it increased the winter DLOL, but it decreased the summer value by 8%. Does that raise any concerns to you? I can understand why having the additional and it mentioned that the, you know, additional capacity in the winter is a good thing, but just wanted to talk a little more about if you had any concerns about the fact that the summer decreased.
Okay. I'm just looking at that portion of this testimony. Mm-hmm. No, that does not cause any concerns. The other one we've seen is the winter DLOL is the most conservative. Okay. Case where we have the most requirements, and that's really showing what we're building towards. So in that case, what this is saying, we are seeing additional benefits over what we modeled in the winter as compared to what there was originally there. So we actually would provide more benefits.
Okay. And then I think my last question is, one of the questions raised in Mr. Heidel's testimony was discussion around, like, the 52% capacity factor. And I think he had some concerns that maybe that was a little ambitious, I guess I'll say. So talk to me a little more about how MDU arrived, or why they're assuming, like, a 52% capacity factor.
So when in a project development, when you look at capacity factors for a project, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of studies that go along with that. One of the pieces that's a part of that is what are you expecting to have for an average wind production? And so there are met towers that are placed on site to actually record what the actual wind conditions are over a period. And I think there's data on some of those towers back to 5-6 years, I think, on some of the locations. And then also taking a look at what some of the historic weather data is in the area. A lot of that is normally like what is NOAA weather. And so in that, there's a way to correlate all of that to get more of this longer-term look of what has the wind resource been, and then to come up with, on a probabilistic basis, what is like a P50, so the average. 50% of the time, it'll be greater. 50% of the time, lower than that, and to use that as a part of that analysis. And then also we'll include that in like an overlay of how the project is laid out to come up with, on that P50 wind scenario, what you end up assuming to be the annual production will end up being. One of the additional things that Badger Wind has also done, and it kind of goes along with the industry as a whole, you know, turbines, you know, become larger, they become more efficient. They're also able to more adapt with different tower sizes and also blade sizes, something that more fits that particular wind pattern, versus saying that somebody may have just had one design or two designs on the shelf a developer could take. They're more able to betterly tailor, you know, a new project and turbines to what you're actually seeing for a resource. And that kind of leads to more production. The other one that a lot of projects have been doing, and Badger Wind is the same, is the interconnection is good for 250 megawatts, but when you take the 92 turbines times the 2.82 megawatts per machine, you end up with almost 260 megawatts of installed capacity that the project ends up having. You know, some of that is to account for maybe a turbine that's offline for maintenance, or it ends up being for just electrical losses that the project has between the production standpoint at the turbines to where the point of interconnection is. So you're able to greatly increase, you know, the utilization of the project and to put more energy on the system if you can construct more turbines as well. So it's a few things that are done. You know, what's the wind analysis you look at? What's the right type of turbines you put in? And also taking a look at, you know, actually what's the total amount of turbines that are installed to say is this, you know, capacity factor realistic or not?
Okay. I think those are all my questions. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Simser, any other or any redirect?
Just a couple of questions, Your Honor. Mr. Nigam, thank you for your wonderful testimony. Just to make sure the record's clear here, without this wind project, what would be the energy exposure to MDU's existing load, or market exposure to MDU's existing load?
Our market exposure that we are forecasting would be about 50% of the energy we'd be purchasing from the market.
And your forecast, does that involve material load growth, or is that really your customer base today?
That's just the customer base today, and that would just be looking at what our current requirement would be for 2025-2026. So that number would grow into the future.
So in other words, the project is needed now to meet today's needs?
Yes, it is.
And those needs are really to insulate customers from material market exposure?
Today and in the future.
Okay. You and Mr. Shook and Commissioner Christman talked a lot about production tax credits. At the end of the day, would MDU treat the production tax credits however the commission ordered?
Yes, we would.
And with respect to your conservative estimates, I wanted to help understand a little bit. The model had a $28 PTC. Was I following correctly?
That is right.
And the if today's PTCs are valued at what again?
$30 is the current value.
Is the current value. And so essentially your model is understating the value of PTCs?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So that means any value that you might get from the PTCs is just additional benefits over that 121.5?
Yes, it is.
Okay. You were asked about base cases and other modeling and how to talk about it in plain English, which I think everybody kind of needs the help sometimes. Would it essentially be fair to say that MDU is looking at a set of resource adequacy rules that are in a state of flux today?
They're in a state of flux, or they're changing.
And because of that, you did more base cases than you normally would? Is that how you did the analysis?
Correct. So historically, as I said, we only would have looked at the summer case, which would be consistent for the RTOs as well. If you have enough resources in the summer, that's where you peak. And so that's what the systems have been planned around. And that is changing in the future, looking at is it in other seasons or moving from like summer to winter, even though we have less load in the winter than summer. Is there more risk in the winter?
But at the end of the day, no matter what base case you looked at, is it your contention that MDU still needs the energy to cover the customers from market risk?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Thank you. I have nothing further.
Mr. Armstrong, any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson?
I do not, but Mr. Schick does.
Within the settlement, there's a provision for a production sharing amount. That's speaking to if the capacity factor falls below 42% on a rolling three-year average, if I'm remembering the provision correctly. Can you talk a little bit more? So you just said the analysis shows 52% capacity factor is what you believe to be reasonable for this wind facility for its annual output on average. Recognize there can be good years and bad years. Does that 52% take into account any curtailment risk, or is that simply what amount of wind is available?
That would end up be what amount of wind is available and also taking a look at potential losses you could have on the system and availability of equipment.
Okay. So no curtailment risk is taken into account with that 52%?
There was no other adjustments made for that.
Okay. Now, this provision seems to kind of try to account for that because it is in a part of the state that is, to a certain extent, transmission constrained, so there is some risk of curtailment over the life. Recognize in the short term maybe there isn't, but over the life there could be some risk of curtailment.
That is correct. Any generator on the system could have risk of curtailment.
Certainly. So this amount of $285,000, what's that based upon?
So when we looked at that when we looked at this, the concern that Mr. Heidel had in his testimony, that he had, you know, we tried to come up with a way that tried to be, you know, I think understanding of what was being asked and the concern and trying to find a way that we thought could best manage that and address that. When we had looked at the $285,000, we kind of went back and looked at past precedents that we ended up having. And a similar situation, maybe we had a reduced revenue requirement, did deal with the reciprocating engine project we built at Lewis and Clark Station in Sydney. So we had taken a 20 basis points reduction, at least in our ROE, at least as a way of showing, you know, a way to have, we'd have either some skin in the game or at least we'd have some way that we could show there was some reduction in the revenue requirement if there was some hurdle that wasn't met.
Sure. So it would be, because so the risk right now for the curtailment would be entirely on customers outside of that $285,000 production sharing amount. Am I right that it's the three-year rolling average capacity factor?
So it would be a three-year rolling average.
Okay. So that outside of that three-year rolling average going at lower than 42%, customers would kind of bear the risk of that curtailment, of any significant curtailments.
So one of the pieces we look at why a three-year rolling, as I mentioned earlier, when we talk about production from the wind project, it is based around the P50 wind production. So if you look at reasons that you could have a reduced output from a project, one could be the winds are less than expected. The other ones could be an issue with the mechanical, you know, operation of the facility, something on the turbine provider side, or the other one could be something like curtailments, an issue on the interconnection. So looking at the three-year average, it doesn't look specifically at 1 year if it's for the P50 wind, but saying how does it compare to the long-term average of what's been modeled? Okay. The other one, there are also mechanisms that are a part of that where if it's a turbine provider mechanical issue, there are ways to have other sorts of, you know, penalty sorts of payments that they could make for an availability penalty, those also would flow back to that calculation if there was some other sort of, you know, offsetting revenue we receive from the turbine manufacturer.
Sure. Okay. How about in under the PPA, where's the curtailment risk lie? Is that with the developer?
So the curtailment risk is a part of that price that they would end up having. So it's how they end up modeling themselves for risk. You know, the same is true, as I mentioned as well, if the project produces greater than 52% capacity factor, the developer continues to earn that as additional revenue they take in. Where in the case of the ownership, it ends up being that all benefit flows back to the customer instead of additional payments.
Sure. Okay. I think that's all I have.
Thank you.
Any other commissioner questions? Commissioner Christman?
So you have the PPA for the 150, and now you come to us to buy 49% of the 122.5. So tells me you feel that that for the 122.5, that's better for MDU than the PPA for those megawatts, correct?
Yes, it is.
So why not buy 60% instead of 49%? Is that because MDU doesn't want to be the majority ownership, or because Ørsted insists on being the majority owner?
In the conversations that we had on purchasing, they had continued to wanting to be the majority owner.
They want to be majority owner. Okay. And in all your financial plans, are you assuming construction of additional transmission down in that area to solve some of the congestion problems that we've had for years and have been partially solved by the data processing center, and having that transmission kind of postage stamped by an RTO as opposed to the developer paying for it?
Yeah. So we do see, you know, at least what historically has been potential for curtailment risk. There are things that are reducing or mitigating that. Commissioner Christman, as you indicated, some of that is the transmission build-outs that are planned in the area to get more of that energy out, and also as far as being able to consume that load in the local area through the data centers does also reduce that potential risk for curtailments.
But which is your financial modeling based on, that those things happen with additional transmission, or is it based on where we're at today and this deal gets even better if additional transmission is built that you don't have to pay for?
So there's no adjustments that are made to any of the inputs in the model, but it does support at least the 52% capacity factor that those things you talked about, you know, are going to be built and also be operating as far as the data centers in the future.
Can you explain it another? Explain it again. I guess I didn't.
Sure. So of looking at the capacity factor, you know, we are assuming, you know, that there is not a significant amount of curtailments that we'll see in that area in the future. And so those can be predicated upon what's being planned for transmission and also as far as what is occurring with load being added down in that area.
Thank you.
All right. That's all the questions for you, Mr. Nygum. Thanks. Okay. Any other witnesses, Mr. Simser?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Advocacy staff calls Rob Frank.
All right, Mr. Frank, I'll have you start by stating your full name for the record and spelling your last name.
It's Robert Frank, FRANK.
Mr. Frank, did you hear me go through the penalties for perjury earlier?
Yes, I did.
And do you understand what perjury is?
Yes, I do.
And being advised the potential penalties for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this case today?
I do.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Armstrong.
Mr. Frank, are you the same Robert Frank that pre-filed direct testimony in support of the settlement that we've marked as Exhibit 12 for the hearing today?
Yes, I am.
And if I were to ask you the same questions on the stand, would you provide the same answers?
Yes, I would.
Thank you, all tender, Mr. Frank.
Mr. Simser, any questions?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson?
I don't, but Mr. Shook does.
So I'm going to ask you one of the questions I asked Darcy earlier about PTC levelization and the net present value impact that would have. So MDU had said they're modeling for the net present value savings for this project did not factor in the PTC levelization that North Dakota uses. I think you generally understand how the PTC levelization works. You're an economist. So in your opinion, do you think it is, how does that impact the net present value calculation? Does that reduce the savings that customers are likely to see, or does that increase the savings customers?
Well, depending on the way you do it, that could impact it. But I think the important thing probably at this point is to remember that if you're doing consistently between the different analysis, then that's going to come out with consistent results. So if you went and if you would change all that for the company's analysis and within the analysis advocacy staff did as well, I think you're looking at apples to apples in that way. But certainly there would be impacts to the net present value.
Sure. Can you think just generally, so the impact of the PTC levelization kind of, it would change the cost to customers by increasing it a little bit in the earlier years. It kind of nets out probably about by year three or four, and then it would increase it from years, probably 5 through 10. And then in the later years, it would lessen the cost. Does that generally translate into a lower net present value or a higher net present value? Just generally. I'm not looking for a specific number, just a general idea. And if you don't know, that's okay. But
yeah, I guess I would generally say it'd probably give you a higher, unless I got things messed up in my brain right now. Again, I would have to say that since analysis wasn't done, I couldn't for sure say anything about what it would net out to.
Sure. So the analysis that your expert conducted, do you know if his analysis included the levelization of PTCs?
It was consistent in the way that MDU treated it as well.
Okay. No other questions.
Commissioner Haugen-Hoffert?
Thank you. Do you support the settlement?
I do.
Can you give a brief overview on why you support it?
I think that the resource that or the ownership is something that would be prudent, and I believe that it also is something that when comparing to the idea of just having a PPA, they're very comparable as well, but there is definitely benefits to having the ownership, and I think that MDU demonstrated that, so I support considering or having this be approved for being a prudent resource addition to MDU's fleet.
Okay. We had a lot of discussion on the modeling that took place, and this ownership has to do with meeting the current needs right now, correct?
Correct.
Was there any futuristic modeling, in your opinion, that was done to address this, why it's needed? Let me rephrase that.
Well,
go ahead.
Essentially, the direct need was derived, as was explained before, that the Minn Kota PPA is expiring, so they'll need a replacement for that. And this resource definitely is prudent and reasonable for a replacement for that.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Commissioner Christman?
Mr. Heidel expressed concerns about the 52% capacity factor, and somewhere in here mentioned something about 47%. But then he did ultimately propose that the company bear the cost difference if the annual capacity factor drops below 42%. So in the settlement agreement, on the third page, that 450,702 megawatt hours, that is 42% capacity factor, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
The production threshold.
But that's 10% lower than the 52. And also in his testimony, he talked about 47 as kind of being a cutoff point, and that he went ultimately down to 42 to look at it, because that would be about as much difference from what he thought seemed like kind of a high number down to 47, and then he took went 5 the other way. So here at 42, 450,000 megawatt hours, if that ends up being the rolling average and they're having to buy that much energy off the market, and they're the reduced revenue is only $285,000. That's like $5 a megawatt hour, and not going to buy much energy for that usually. So why $285,000? It just seems like, based on these numbers, that is what I see in here that seems remarkably low. And on the customer, as the customer's advocate, can you explain agreeing to that?
That number was derived from settlement negotiations. And so essentially, it's not going to have, it has a logical tie to being 20 basis points off of the revenue requirement. And so if that's derived from settlement, it's not going to exactly line up with what the possibilities are, but through negotiation.
And what was the 20% based on? Something with the facility at Sydney?
Yeah, I believe so.
So that's not really any real precedent that we have. A whole different scenario, isn't it?
No, not. Well, it is some sort of precedent, but not directly related to this. And there's a novelty to this that we haven't seen before.
But you feel the 285 is reasonable?
I do feel it's reasonable, and I support that.
Okay. And then I think Mr. Shook kind of covered it, but I just want to hear it in a different way. On redirect, Mr. Nigam said that, this is my best effort to take notes and quote him, that MDU will treat the PTCs however the commission orders, as far as over 20 years or the life of the facility or whatever. As the consumer advocate, are you comfortable, are you agreeable to that too, if we change that time frame on the levelization?
Yes, I am. I believe the settlement agreement simply states that MDU has a proposed treatment of PTCs, and it does not dictate what the method should be or what, and that I'm very comfortable with that being left up to the commission and worked out by MDU and the commission.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Kringstad?
I think most of mine have been answered. I just want to touch on a little more. So in Mr. Heidel's testimony, we've talked a lot about like the 52% capacity factor, and then he put in like a 5% band. Can you give me a little more information about like why he picked 5 as opposed to, say, like 3, 10, like where that's maybe coming from.
The 5% band, as far as I understand, comes from the analysis that he did. And you can pick different points looking at analyzing the PPA at different capacity factors and looking at the ownership. And what the analysis showed was that, you know, from that 42 to 47%, the PPA would look more beneficial. I do believe that if you would like to ask that to Mr. Heidel as well, he'd be able to clear that up a little bit more.
And I think you touched on this earlier, but it's your opinion that ownership is preferable to just a full power purchase agreement, correct?
My opinion is that I support the settlement agreement with the contingencies that have been in place, along with the ownership option. As long as those things are presented in the settlement agreement, then yes, I support that.
No, that's all the questions I had. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong, any redirect?
Thank you. Yes, I just have a few. Mr. Frank, as advocacy staff, you're at least generally and fairly specifically familiar with Mr. Heidel's testimony, correct?
Correct.
Is it fair to say that Mr. Heidel concluded that a wind resource was a prudent choice by MDU in this case?
That is correct.
And then Mr. Heidel also evaluated the difference in impacts from a PPA versus ownership by MDU. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And in the evaluation of the PPA versus ownership is where Mr. Heidel discussed some of the risks to customers for curtailment that are different between a PPA and ownership.
Correct.
And so in a PPA, there are certain protections that may not exist in ownership, correct?
That is correct. Yep.
And in ownership, there's some benefits that may not exist in a PPA, correct?
Correct.
And kind of the breaking point between the PPA and ownership was that 47% capacity factor, correct?
Yes.
And when we talk about the condition for curtailment that's being recommended in a settlement, that is a condition to address some of the differences between a PPA and ownership to protect customers based on those specific differences, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Simpson, any other questions?
Yes, Your Honor, real quick. And just to be clear that this provision that is intended to provide customers protections as they would have in the PPA, that's not symmetrical with respect to MDU, or said differently, when you have these kinds of protections in a PPA, the developer also gets the upside. MDU is not getting any upside in this outcome.
Yes, I agree with that.
And when we look at the net benefits, is it your learned opinion that however we may choose to levelize PTCs, there would still be general net benefits for customers?
That's correct. Yep.
And at the end of the day, if we levelize PTCs, would it be fair to essentially say all you're doing is moving the timing of which customers benefit when, rather than the actual total amount of PTCs to be received for the project?
Yes, but there could be differences in the method, though, for when you're making that calculation for the net present value, of course.
And that's just a really question about discounting and timing of the net present value, right?
That's right, and that's a standard method thing. And
But on a nominal basis, it doesn't really change anything.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
Okay. I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson or Mr. Shook, any other questions?
Nothing from us, no.
Any other commissioner questions? Oh, all right. Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Thank you.
Any other witnesses, Mr. Armstrong?
Subject to the commission's, whether the commission desires to call Mr. Heidel, I have confirmed that on page 13, the number 3 was a typo. It should be 2 in the chart that Commissioner Christman was referencing. Should be 250.3 instead of 350.3.
Do the commissioners want Mr. Heidel to provide testimony this morning?
That's all my question.
All right.
I thought I totally fundamentally didn't understand.
So yours.
We all missed it.
All right. Well, then we will move to public testimony. Do we have any members of the public that want to testify this morning? All right. Seeing none, then we will move to closing remarks. And I'll start with you, Commissioner Haugenhofer.
Well, thank you, everyone, for the detailed information and sometimes having to repeat it in a different way. I greatly appreciate it. A lot of information is here, so thank you again for those who testified.
Commissioner Christman.
I will just say regarding those, the PTC levelization, that was a work of a long progress and a lot of effort, and something that I'm really proud of this commission on. I think we've been absolute leaders around the nation, and I'm shocked that not more states have started doing it, because I think it is a fundamental fairness thing for people way down the road. And I do think that it should always be based on the life of the project, not on any time horizon that is less than the anticipated life of the project, because never, in my opinion, should we base a generation plan have a plan that assumes that way down the road, the people who weren't even customers in the decision-making time didn't get an opportunity to speak at a public hearing. All of a sudden, the costs rise up dramatically because of some perk that was involved in creating it having run out, and when we knew that it was going to run out. And so I appreciate both the companies and advocacy staff's willingness to let us do that. Mr. Shook explained the three different, we called them at the time looks. He used the term method today, and the look that we chose was kind of named after a fundamental genius that came up with the correct plan. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you everyone for your time today.
Commissioner Kringstad?
I don't have any closing comments. Just thanks, everybody, for being here today. And maybe just one point of clarification, Judge, and to the rest of the parties. I thought Mr. Nigam said that they were asking for a decision by September 30th. So just want to verify if that's accurate, but that's all I have.
And yes, the answer is that is very accurate, and in fact, we would propose to get a proposed order filed yet today or tomorrow to help speed that along. You know, it's a kind of a hard contractual deadline, and with scheduling and things, unfortunately, we're just here today, and it is really important for the project to be successful to be able to get an order prior to that date.
Okay, and if I didn't say September 30th, that's...
That's
correct. Is that what I said and what I meant? Okay, perfect. Good. Check.
We're on the same page.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So we just address a proposed order. You said today or tomorrow, Mr. Simser?
Yes.
Okay. I assume that's acceptable, Mr. Armstrong?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'll just ask if there's any other matters either party wants to address before we conclude. Mr. Simser, did you have anything?
I don't have anything.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor. Thank you, everyone.
Mr. Johnson?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Christman.
I'm sorry to hold it. Can I consult
with Sure, absolutely.
Staff for just a second. So, Your Honor, I think I misunderstood something. I thought that the company was requesting that we approve a settlement by tomorrow. And I don't see how we can recalculate PTC and do all that, but I understand now that that was something else. So,
well, good. I'm glad we got that cleared up. So
am I.
All right. Any other matters to address? All right. Then I will note that it's 9:50 a.m., and that will conclude our hearing in case numbers PU-25-75 and PU-25-76. Thank you.